Hey there, everybody.
Hello.
Welcome back to Lost in the Vault, where we take an informal, irreverent look at the Disney films that don't quite have the magic. I'm your host, Don Agatone.
And I'm the other one.
Yeah, this is Amanda Dukowitz.
And it's time to be spooky. I should have said hello like that, like, hello.
That would have ruined our typical energy, though, Amanda.
It probably would have, but, you know, I was also wiggling my fingers as emphasis.
You can't see your fingers, though. This is a podcast.
That's why I had to say it. To show how much I was emphasizing.
God damn it, Amanda. God damn you.
I emphasize. I'm fucking Italian. There's nothing scarier than
I'm Italian too. You don't see me gesticulating my hands wildly. I'm certainly not doing that.
It was really hard starting a podcast being Italian because me and Dallin would just sit there and gesticulate at each other instead of speaking. So it's a real burden for us.
Were we known for doing that?
No, we weren't. I was just making an Italian joke and how it must be hard for Italians to have podcasts because half their speech is hand movement.
Mm. When we have Darcy Meadows on the show at some point, shout out to Darcy. Super proud of you, girl.
Our next episode, we're also going to have an Italian guest, so.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. We're here. It's Halloween. I've been preparing for Halloween for the past 2 months, but I stress-baked pumpkin snacks twice already this week. So, half out of excitement and half out of stress, so, you know. I made pumpkin cheesecake bars topped with raspberry jam and cinnamon apple.
I'm not there in person to gorge, especially since this weekend is my birthday.
Yeah. I also made pumpkin chocolate chip cookies, which turned out weird, but good.
Sounds weird, yeah. But good.
Yeah. I mean, well, they turned out weird because they have more of the texture of cakes rather than cookies. So it's like you pick it up and it just kind of like crumbles a bit and you're like, huh? But enough of my baking.
Yeah, especially since I can't eat it. So why bother?
Yeah, I apologize.
You should be sorry.
Yeah, I'm very sorry.
This is Lost in the Vault's first Halloween season. We actually did plan to do the Halloween stuff earlier back. You see, the process of getting Lost in the Vault officially gone was mainly a process of, hey, let's do this. Yeah, we should do this. Never actually committing to starting doing this. So on and so forth for all time.
Until for some reason we decided to start it like at the beginning of like finals last year.
Yeah, in November. I remember when we actually committed to this. It was last year. We were celebrating my birthday at the Times Square Dave and Buster's, enjoying a lovely feast of nachos and blue cocktails.
Yes. Oh my god, that was the day I left my my bag in the fucking Dave and Buster's before seeing Jojo Rabbit.
We're descending the escalators.
No, we weren't descending the escalators. We were almost to the subway stop at that point. Do you remember that? We were like out of the Dave and Buster's and I was like, I'm missing something. Wait a minute.
The complex that also holds the Times Square Dave and Buster's also holds one of the Cedar District Applebee's and a Spirit Halloween store.
Yes. And so we are on our way to this movie to be like just on time for it. And I suddenly stop and go, I'm missing everything that is important to me. And I spin around on my heel and I run back up to the Dave and Buster's and I pluck. I'm freaking out because I'm like, I don't know where it is. Where did I leave it? And I was like, I'm going to go to the place I think that I would have left it, which was the Luigi's Mansion thing, because it's one of those like booth style shooter things in arcades. And
with curtains.
With curtains and everything. So I literally just ripped open the curtain. There were two like children in there and they were like, "What?" And I just reached down and I grabbed my bag and I was like, "Sorry," and I left. And then we ran and we saw Jojo Rabbit and it was very good. Yeah. But it was a good day.
It was a good day.
Yeah, that was just one of probably the most stressful moments I've had.
Probably one of my favorite birthdays that we've celebrated together. What other?
Nice.
Because before, usually our birthday tradition was that we'd like see a movie and then have dinner at the Times Square Hard Rock. So that was a nice change of pace.
Yeah, it was a little bit different. Yeah.
One shitty Times Square chain restaurant for another.
Yeah. This year for my birthday, I got drunk and watched JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. Wow. Yeah. I'm going to be excited to go to the movies again once it's safe to do so.
Yeah, I miss the cinema. I mean, at least I have the Delphi Drive-In, the old New Jersey's only drive-in theater.
I have no car here.
So we've got two films that we're going to be doing this Halloween season. And the first I specifically chose for its historical significance. This film was the first full-on horror film that Disney ever released from 1980 and also technically 1981, The Watcher in the Woods.
Ooh. Spooky.
This film was a movie.
Yeah. Before we move on to the fact that we have two Halloween ones this month, I'm not going to give away what the next one is, but I think this month's are a good indication of, I think you chose this one. Did you choose this one?
I chose this one.
I was going to say, you definitely chose this one and I definitely chose the next one.
Yeah, I remember because for the Halloween ones, we each chose one, and then we were going to do the same for last Christmas, but you were just like, and you choose both.
Yeah, but I am very excited for these episodes because of the dichotomy, I think, of them. We do a time leap, but...
episode we choose, one or both of us ends up regretting it. Usually me.
Yes. I'm good at making people regret things. Yeah, so let's talk about this one, because this one has an interesting story behind it.
So this movie, The Watcher in the Woods, is based off a 1976 novel by Florence Engel Randall, published under the title A Watcher in the Woods. I guess the letter A wasn't the popular trend at the time.
It's more official when it's The Watcher.
Yeah, yeah, I think The Watcher has a better ring to it, in all honesty. But...
I think it works better for this movie because A Watcher in the Woods is a little bit more vague, and I think a little bit... I think we'll get to that when we get to that. This movie's weird.
Yeah, this movie was initially optioned by Disney producer Tom Leach to then head of Walt Disney Productions, Ron Miller. We've talked about Ron Miller in our Pete's Dragon episode, and this is part of that like phase of Disney where they were trying to catch up with like the hip cool kids on like what was popular. So they start branching out into like non-family film genres, and you know, it's films like this, The Black Hole, Trenchcoat, all previous Lost in the Vault entries, and then stuff we haven't talked about yet, like Midnight Madness and Tron, and it's films like that that leads to the creation of Touchstone Pictures. Because for a lot of these like more adult oriented genre heavy Disney films, Disney would like to downplay their involvement. Not with this one though. Disney's name is all over the marketing of this movie. Did you see any of the trailers for this movie?
I did not.
I love how the theatrical trailer opens. It like opens with this a gravelly movie trailer voice, one of the stock voiceovers, being like,
of course,
Walt Disney Productions ushers in a new decade of motion picture entertainment with the following invitation to spend 90 minutes on the edge of your seat. Like,
wow.
And then at the end of the trailer, there's a disclaimer warning you, parents, not to take their young ones, even though it has the Disney name on it. Disney really wanted you to know that they were going hardcore for this one, which makes the resulting film kind of a letdown, especially since when Tom Leach pitched the film to Ron Miller, mm-hmm. he said it as, quote, "This could be our Exorcist."
This movie has the backing to be like it had people involved. They plucked a lot of different people from various like horror movies and with different like experiences in horror. Like they got Kyle Richards from the Halloween movies, and the director directed like one of the most legendary Hammer movies, The Legend of Hell House.
A couple of the writers, Brian Clemens and Henry Spaulding, also did some writing stuff on Hammer stuff. Brian Clemens, who wrote the initial draft of the screenplay, wrote Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde, and wrote and directed Captain Kronos Vampire Hunter, as well as Highlander 2, The Quickening.
Like, there were some, like, pretty good, you know, like, they did some research into who they were getting onto this, you know?
I should also mention that John Hughes, the director of this, he also directed two future Lost in the Vault entries, Escape to Witch Mountain and Return from Witch Mountain, and then also probably one of the best car chase movies of the 70s, Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry. Have you seen that one?
I have not.
It's supposedly one of Quentin Tarantino's favorite movies. And
nice.
In fact, they even outright name drop it in Death Proof, which is underrated, in my opinion.
Yeah, I like Death Proof. Yeah, and then Carol Baker, who spent her early career wasn't in horror, but then she was like in a bunch of giallo movies, like it throughout like the 60s and 70s and everything. And so it's really interesting because you have the Hammer films, you have like the slasher film person, you have like the Italian cinema person, you know, and it's like you have all of these elements here of people who know what they're doing in a horror movie. And Bette Davis and like a bunch of other people who know what they're doing.
Legendary screen actress Bette Davis celebrating the 50th anniversary of her film career with this movie, which remember that's going to come back later.
And so that's really interesting because this movie does things. not then, really. This movie doesn't do much.
Yeah, that's the weird thing about this movie. Like, it's got the elements there for the makings of a great family-friendly horror film.
Yeah.
But it just doesn't come together, and I can't quite place why.
It kind of, I think it has a similar problem to The Black Hole, in which there are, like, elements there of, this should be a good sci-fi movie, you know? Let's do things in the, do things in this genre or whatever. And then they're like, oh, let's like, I don't know. In that one, they're like, let's have cheesy robots, but also have like these really beautiful space backgrounds and it's really dark and trippy and everything. But it doesn't wind up working because of tone and stuff like that. And this one, I think, runs into tone issues too. I think that it is trying to dip its toes into a genre that it's done surface level research in, if that makes sense.
Oh, you know? No, I totally agree there.
Yeah.
I'm already forgetting parts of this movie, and I saw it like a couple hours ago.
I also saw it a couple hours ago, and I watched the shitty version on YouTube because that's...
Same! Twinsies!
The only... Yeah, that's the only place I could find it. I was not surprised it wasn't on Disney Plus, but I was also like, they could have thrown this on there. I don't know.
It's weird because it's not like one of the films that's like tied up in other, you know, streaming mm-hmm. services or premium cable packages. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no logical reason why it shouldn't be there.
It's like, I mean, like, you could make an argument that it's like a horror movie, so they might not want to put it on there for family audiences, but like,
does that hold up though? They're like,
no, it doesn't.
The Pirates of the Caribbean movie, they have more intense shit than this.
I know, and there's plenty of scary shit on Disney Plus. So I don't know. Yeah.
I think the reason why this film came out so lackluster is that if you look at its behind-the-scenes history, there were supposedly a lot of creative mm-hmm. conflicts between the film's co-producer Tom Leach and the director John Hugh and the film's producer and also then head of Disney, Ron Miller, whom Ron mm-hmm. Miller was always concerned that, is this too scary for Disney? Which, you know, this is definitely the clear, like, growing pains.
Yeah.
Of between, like, Disney trying to compete in you know, the late 70s, early 80s, you know, like, New Hollywood blockbuster era. And then eventually they're just like, fuck it, let's just make Touchstone.
Yeah.
And that's not even getting into the shit with the ending.
Yes, the ending is definitely, like, it's a very funny story, in my opinion. But it's also kind of sad because of what it meant for the movie. But I think we'll get to that later on because I think
we want to talk about like the changes in the ending when we actually get to the ending in the story.
Yeah, cool.
So, Watcher in the Woods. How does this start? It starts off with no beginning because, initially, in the original cut of the film, there was a cold opening involving a little girl in the woods, no one who actually factors into the actual story, mind you, playing with her doll, only to approach the woods, get scared by the quote-unquote watcher in the woods, which zaps her doll, incinerating it. Title appears over the burning doll, you know, cut to like the actual beginning.
The one thing I do like, and it's not perfect, but I kind of do like the mood, it is like the weird music that plays over the intro credits, which is like this weird like little lullaby intercut by like orchestral like kind of bullshit of like, you know, typical horror movie like violins kind of, but there's a lot of moments of silence in it where like it just stops and then there's more lullaby stuff, but like it's very slow and very like it's quiet, and I was like, you know what, that's actually pretty cool in my opinion. I really liked the opening song sequence.
Yeah, that was good, but
mm-hmm.
the actual opening is literally just like a family driving into a house, you know.
Oh yeah, we're buying a house. Okay, it's haunted. Do you really think?
Here's the thing. I think I've pinpointed what this film doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
The filmmaking itself is very nice and atmospheric. The performances are, for the most part, solid. Though I do think that Lynn Holly Johnson, who plays the main girl, mm-hmm. Jen Curtis, is not the best at this. I think too much of the time she's like in like Disney actress mode, which I mean makes sense because this was like her second feature film. Beforehand, she was a competitive figure skater and then performed the Ice Capades. And then her first feature film was 1978's Ice Castles, which is a romantic drama starring her and Robbie Benson about a figure skater that goes blind in an accident. Anyone today who's never heard of it might it's the movie that like the second half of Anchorman 2 was parodying. When Ron Burgundy goes blind.
Yeah, she is trying, I think, a little bit too much. She overplays it.
I She actually really didn't have much of a career after this. She was in the next year, she was played BB Doll in the James Bond film For Your Eyes Only. Mm-hmm. And then in 1984, she plays one of the main girls in Where the Boys Are 84, a darker, grittier remake of the 60s teen comedy drama film Where the Boys Are, which is an odd choice to gritify, because if you've seen Where the Boys Are, it's already rather edgy and gritty for the time period.
I've never seen it.
Oh, the original or the remake?
Either.
I stumbled on that movie on Turner Classic Movies one morning. And I was surprised I actually really got into it. If you ever like find it on the schedule, definitely check it out. It's definitely worth a watch.
Okay.
And then afterwards, her acting career sort of peters out, and then she ends up retiring in the 90s to raise a family.
Well, good for her. I hope she's happy, you know.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure she is. Her most recent acting role was that she was in a community theater production of It's a Wonderful Life for the Newport Beach Repertory Theater.
Nice. She plays in this movie what is one of two sisters. And she's the older sister.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is her younger sister, who is played by Kyle Richards. And
I should point this out, that apparently the first choice for Jan, Holly Johnson's character, the first choice was Diane Lane, but she was busy.
So we have this family in a car, and these are our two kind of main characters that we're supposed to be following. But it becomes one of those movies that there's like, I don't know, you can call them main characters, but they're more slaves to the scenario that they're in rather than, they're more participants rather than characters.
Definitely. They're very stock.
Yeah.
The male lead, like the love interest I get, doesn't even really get an introduction. You notice that? He just appears.
He just appears and he sucks.
I don't know. I mean, he's a pretty sweet motocross racer.
He does, but then we'll get to it later. So they get to this house and they're like, it's so cheap. What's the catch? And the little girl's like, I bet there's ghosts. And it's like, yeah, no shit.
We should mention that this house is like a fucking mansion in the English countryside.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
And very rustic.
It's owned by
Bette Davis.
Bette Davis. Everyone's favorite old lady who, in this movie, she was just kind of paid to stand there around and scowl a lot.
That's the weird thing. Like, they make a big deal about Bette Davis being in this movie. She barely does anything. I mean,
she stands and scowls.
In theory, she should have the most interesting part in this whole thing. Like, a better movie, the whole drama should revolve around her, but nope.
Yeah. So they get to the house and they meet Bette Davis, and there, you know, something spooky's already happened. There's just a bunch of spooky wind and, you know, weird shit like happening right off the bat, and it's like, all right, yep.
Another thing, like, ideally, for like a supernatural horror film like this, you want like a slow and steady build up before you get into the fireworks. But pretty much the only like scare that they can think of for the most part is lightning flashes, something happens, like blue lightning appears,
and that's
you know, no tension, no increasing dread, just flash, 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 flash.
This is a horror movie without tension. It's a series of images until it's over.
That's a great way of putting it.
It's a series of images of what could be parts of a horror movie. that don't almost lead up to something, I will say. So they get into the house and they're like, are you respectable people or whatever? And then the father starts playing like jazz on the piano. And who was it? That was it, the realtor?
Yeah, yeah, it was the realtor.
The realtor was like, I thought you played opera, not this low down whatever. And I thought you were a real artist. And I was like, he's beautifully playing the piano. What are you talking about?
You're trying to sell him a fucking house, lady. Like, yeah. How bad are you at your job?
And he says something along the lines of like, oh, well, I play very well in the dark of night or whatever. And it was it had a very like heavy sexual insinuation. I was like, what the fuck?
I think I completely did not pick this up like until much later on in the movie. The dad, played by David McCollum, he's not Lynn Holly Johnson and Kyle Richards' biological father in the movie. He's supposed to be like a stepdad, I think.
Is he?
Yeah. Because Kyle Richards mentions later in the movie about their dad coming to visit. So I guess
I forgot about that.
I guess the mother's divorced. They never,
I guess so.
You know, this would be nice information to have at the beginning. You know, especially when there's like this tension between mother and daughter that comes right the fuck out of nowhere. You notice that part?
Yeah. Everyone in this family like kind of fucking hates each other. Like they all sass each other, but not like in a cute kind of like, haha sister, haha mother, or whatever kind of way. It's like, are you excited to be moving into this new house? No. Are you like, what's happening? Fuck, like the father like hates the mother, and like it's just none of them like each other.
I did not pick that up. I actually thought there was some pretty positive chemistry between the two sisters and the rest.
But other than the sisters, there's a line between the mother and the father that I'm trying to remember. It was like something about them, about getting married, making someone be happy, and he's like, then why did I do it? Or something like that. And it was like, bro, like...
That's like 90s sitcom humor.
Yeah, but it's like, it wasn't even like a funny joke, like, haha, marriage is difficult, it comes with, you know, whatever, and like, even in the sitcom sense, it was just straight up like, I hate my life, and I hate who I married to. And it's like, okay.
Maybe it was like a resentment over the fact that this hot broad came with kids and he didn't want to be his dad. He just wanted a nice blonde with a big rack.
Mm. Who knows? Because this movie doesn't have themes or character or anything. So
it starts and then stops.
So let's... What happens in this movie? Bette Davis immediately likes Jan, the older daughter, upon seeing her.
Yeah.
It
can't decide between likes her or is very intense and foreboding towards her. Like, it
is at least definitely intrigued and obsessed with her. Not in, I mean, in a weird way, but like, it not like in a...
Not like, in a sexual context.
No. In a, you can tell that her backstory has something to do with somebody who probably looks exactly like her. You know, kind of way.
Yeah.
Like, it's a very predictable kind of like, oh, she probably had a daughter or something like that. And then she did. So.
Do you just want to tell like the backstory of what happened right now? Just so that we're not just like, because I don't really feel like having to like slowly release information as we go along with the movie's plot.
Yeah, so basically what happened was this lady's daughter disappeared in the woods and she's been sad about it for years. And that's why she's so angry all the time. That's why she's scowling all the time, is because she tragically lost her daughter, and she knows that there's people out there that probably know what happened, but nobody will tell her. You
this
know,
feels that, like this should be like a town with a dark secret type thing.
Yeah. Where,
and like, I guess if you look at it like on a story level, it is, but
yeah,
how it played
out
in the
people
movie,
involved.
It doesn't feel like that at all. Like, you yeah. know, no, we, the people who were involved don't show up until like far too late into the story to like
oh, yeah.
make any meaningful addition to the text of the film. So
Yeah. So they meet Bette Davis and they move into the house and weird shit starts happening. The younger sister finds a dog and starts writing its name in condensation on the window and is like, its name is Narek. And then the older sister's like, where'd you get that from? And the little sister's like, didn't you whisper that to me? And she was like, no. And then somebody goes outside and there's a dramatic zoom in on the window and it spells Karen.
Red rum, red rum. Yeah.
And Karen is the name of the daughter that disappeared in the woods.
What a Karen.
Yeah. So like this again does have elements of things that could work. I mean, the writing the name backwards is kind of stupid. But you know, a little girl being like, so you're the one that said that to me, right? And her going, no, is fine, you know.
The thing. You
huh?
Here's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
If the film started out with the watcher doing like the subtle shit, and that if the film started out with the watcher doing only the subtle shit, and then it slowly progressed to doing bigger and bigger things, that then you've got something there. But here instead, yeah. it like flips back and forth between like more subtle stuff between, and then flash, you know, flash of light causes knocks, Lynn Holly Johnson into the water and she gets pinned down with a branch or something.
Yeah. Oh no, she cuts her hand because of a weird flash of light and she sees something in the woods and all this shit and it's like, okay. And then there's whispers.
You can't have it both ways, or at least you got it.
You gotta do it. You gotta build up.
It doesn't have patience.
No. So, that night, the two sisters decide to, I think, stay in the same room, because of some spooky shit that's been happening and stuff like that. And the one, older sister, the older sister goes, if we talk in our sleep, it won't wake, if we talk in our sleep, then we won't wake each other. Does that make sense? And the little sister goes, no. And as if the little sister knows how none of the writing in this movie makes any sense at all, which it doesn't. So.
I just don't know what to make of this movie, honestly. You can cut that. Let's just progress. Mm-hmm. So,
okay. So we get Bette Davis's character's backstory, and we learn that she thinks that Karen isn't dead, and that there's somebody out there that did something to her, but that she's still out there too. And after we get this revelation, suddenly there's dirt bikes.
Yeah, also part of the revelation is that so apparently there were like three witnesses to the whole affair, other children who are like now adults in the village that like have the burden of this secret. And, you know, that could be some interesting drama, you know, how is it? And it, in theory, there should be some interesting drama there and how it like shapes them, but barely glossed over.
Yeah. So. So now, dirt bikes, hell yeah. And suddenly, we are with the love interest of the older sister, who is just dirt biking, and then his dirt bike just kind of veers off and explodes. And the older sister's like, well, good thing. What did she do?
So, they get closer to the motocross race to watch it by sitting on a rock, and then the younger sister like goes to like a different place to find it. And then she like starts screaming about, older sister, come here, like with this great urgency. And so the older sister goes to see her, and then immediately afterwards, a motorbike skids off and lands where she, where the older sister was previously standing, and explodes. And then, like, the older sister's like, what did you need me for? Oh, I didn't need you. Nerak needed you. Like, Nerak wanted you over here. So
it's almost, it's more humorous than scary.
It's, I mean, and this is, and also, I think this scene provides like an example of another problem I have with this movie, and that the editing at times is a bit haphazard. Like, like you see a shot of little sister climbing up a hill, and then we get an all too short shot of the motocross race, and then we cut back and it's like a close-up of the girl on top of the hill, and like, wait, how'd she get there that fast? We didn't establish that. Yeah. Like, you're thrown off. Also,
there's a few shots where they zoom in very fast on things, very dramatically, and it's very funny. So that happens. So this guy's dirt bike explodes, and she's just like, okay. And he's like, good thing I had luck. And then they're like, bro, that wasn't luck. There's something haunting us. And then we find out that this dude's mom was one of the kids.
Yeah.
So, he, what happens after that?
I couldn't tell you. This is, maybe it's a fool's errand to like go through this plot in order. Maybe we should just, as Jack would put it, go for like a more holistic approach to it.
Totally. So what I remember is that this dude's mom is involved, and there's two other adults involved. Tom and this dude that goes by Mr. Keller. And Mr. Keller is the kind of main, like,
aristocrat.
He is what acts as the most like resistant force in the movie that provides like any bit of tension, because he's the one who's like to the other adults like, shh, don't tell anybody like about this event.
But of course, we're not even hinted at this. He doesn't even show up until like over halfway through the movie.
Yeah. So he is just this rich, like he's just living in this rich bitch house. And he's just like living by himself all alone. And he's always like, you know, this is my private property, like nobody come near me. And it's interesting. It's cool, because his house was the house used in 1963's The Haunting.
Do you know really? Yes, yeah. I love that movie.
Which is based on the Shirley Jackson book. It's based on the Shirley Jackson book, The Haunting of Hill House, which is also one of my favorite books. So this house is pretty dope-ass house that they don't spend enough time in if they're going, you know, it's the fucking haunting house, you know, like that's cool as shit. And this character is the one person that is somewhat of an antagonist in some regards, because, you know, the antagonist is like supernatural forces or whatever, but like he is the closest thing to a human antagonist that we have. And it would be interesting if they went further with it and he could have been chilling in his haunted house. Well, his, not his haunted house, his house from The Haunting, 1963. And, you know, so he's just this like asshole who's like, shh, you can't tell anybody and whatever. And then the other two, the one of them is the love interest mother who was just kind of like, I don't want to talk about it, but here's some information just because, you know, you asked about it and I don't know what to do.
And the other is the crazy Ralph from Friday the 13th.
So the other's name is, the other is named Tom, and he lives, what, in the woods? Where does he live?
He's like a hermit. He's got like a shack.
Yeah, he's got a shack where he rehabilitates animals that are trapped in the woods. So he goes around and he finds these animals and it's really sweet. And
what was his name again?
Tom.
Last name?
I don't remember. Hold up.
Because they refer to him with like both first and last
name. Tom Colley.
Ah. There once was a man named Tom Colley, a naturalist, noble and jolly. A friend of all beasties, the most and the leasties.
Damn.
I just really wanted to reference a decades plus computer game that only nerds have played.
So yeah, Tom's here and he is the one that kind of is like, he's the one that's really resistant but like tells her the most, I think. And he reveals that there was a, like, they did some kind of ritual. An undisclosed kind of ritual of just, they were in this old church and they did it. And it was Kelly's doing. It was Keller's doing.
Yeah.
He was the one that kind of led the thing. He was like, oh, he was a part of the secret society that did this, but it's just the three of them, and the kid's like, Kid Keller is like, oh, well, we three have already passed our tests or whatever in this thing, so now we're initiating you.
It's just a goofy kid group initiation thing. They've got, they form a circle around her, and what's Karen's blindfold in, like, the center?
Yeah.
And it's in a cathedral during a lunar eclipse. Yeah, so Karen just like, you know, flash of blue lightning as usual. Like, we haven't seen enough of that shit.
Yeah.
Sound a bit like filthy Frank there. At that
moment. God.
You know what I hate? I hate Disney movies that use an overabundance of blue lightning.
Oh, wow, you're taking me back to like 2014 when I was watching Filthy Frank. I fucking love that kids didn't know that he was Filthy Frank and only know him as Joji, as a musical artist, which is really funny.
Only know Filthy Frank from like one or two videos, and then also Pink Guy's Nickelodeon girl son.
Yeah, I just remember I remember Pink Guy. And just the voice, and it's time to stop. That's it.
That's probably gonna do hell in my vocal cords. Just that one line alone.
We were talking about what happened to Karen, and then how did we get from this movie to Filthy Frank?
We were talking about Blue Lightning. I was expressing my frustration with the goddamn lightning. Blue Lightning.
And then you said you sounded like Filthy Frank. There's a lot of blue lightning in this movie, and it's the only kind of like motif that we have of whatever this force is that is messing with them. It strikes lightning and it whispers.
And but we don't hear the whispers. No. We just hear other people mention the whispers.
Yeah. The
master of tension here.
Yeah. So at one point, the three kids, so the two sisters and the love interest, are riding horses.
Wildfire.
And they're riding horses, and then they almost get hit by a car, but then they get saved, and then they wind up in the church where it happened, and the older sister finds a circle and goes, "Circles must mean something." So they think circles mean something now, too, and that's one of the other quote-unquote motifs. It's a fucking circle, dude. The sister starts, she's been seeing, but she keeps seeing, the little sister hears the whispers, and the older sister sees the ghost of, or not the ghost, the, what, you whatever know, the movie kind of sets
with,
up.
Whatever's happening with Karen.
Mm-hmm. The movie kind of almost sets it up, just like you see just, like, this weird blindfolded child.
There actually is a really solid sequence. Set up mm-hmm. in like a hall of mirrors that I actually thought was pretty cool. Like
that was
okay.
Good.
You had one good moment, movie. Way to go. Mm-hmm.
She goes to the fair and sees the ghost in the hall of mirrors, and then she comes out and she's like, "Oh man, she was in there, whatever." And the boyfriend's like, "Fucking relax, man. Like chill. Like there's not. What are you talking about? You're crazy." And it's like, weren't you like kind of on board for this kind of stuff? You know, like, you've already witnessed a few crazy shit, crazy things, some crazy shit.
Amanda, character consistency is for fools.
You're right, I'm sorry.
The key to supremely terrifying horror is not for, to come from placing characters in situations where they have to react and fight for survival and mm-hmm. question their own sanity. And, you know, have to fight their own adrenaline and nerves and the like. It's just have random shit happen to people and then keep things proceeding as normal. And yet they inexplicably start to act like crazy out of the blue. No buildup. We don't need buildup. We don't need, you know, we don't need like a slow build of stakes and tension to create a sense of dread that progresses in outright horror. Who the fuck needs that? Blue lightning. Yeah. That's all we need. Just keep that shit flashing.
This would have been better as a Frank Zappa song.
Blue lightning, just keep shit flashing.
It would have made more sense as a Frank Zappa song. As you were describing, as someone who doesn't listen to a lot of Frank Zappa, but the last episode you were describing how a Frank Zappa song is just kind of laid out, where things just keep happening and there's no anything, there's no character growth or anything whatsoever. They just happen. And you can say the same thing about this movie.
How's my Zap impression?
It's a good Zap impression.
Damn straight.
So Bette Davis hasn't been in the movie for a while, and then she comes back, and she and the younger sister. It's a really sad scene, honestly. She's like, come on and have some tea with me or whatever. And the younger sister's like, okay, yay. And like they go in or whatever, and Bette Davis is like, I'm gonna play this this lullaby on this thing and on this music box. And you tell me if you hear any singing, because her daughter, that was her daughter's music box, and the little girl has been hearing the daughter singing the song, which is really sad because the mother's like, this child is my only connection to my own. And then the scene is cut in half, and something possesses the younger sister.
Yeah.
Wait,
that's another thing I just realized. Why? I don't get why the Watcher seems to be targeting both sisters in different ways. Wouldn't it make more sense for like narrative economy to have it work both ways?
What do you mean? Like,
have it that the Watcher's both like showing one of the sisters like these visions of the girl and the blue lightning and then also possessing her, like, right?
Yeah. I think so. Unless the Watcher wanted to mess with one of the sisters more so psychologically, you know.
But why would the Watcher mess with one of the sisters psychologically? Like,
we don't know anything about the Watcher.
Well, do you want to discuss its like character motivations?
Does it have them?
In theory, it does, but that gets into like the whole clusterfuck regarding the multiple endings. So
I didn't. Okay. So basically, the rest of this movie is just kind of descends into what happens. So like basically, they go and they have to recreate the ritual, and they wound up convincing everyone involved from the first one to go do it somehow.
Yeah,
and
see, in most stories, it's this happens, which results in this leading to this, you know, stuff builds on top of each other. Nope, it's just this happens, this happens, this happens, and then in between, they inexplicably decide to do things.
Yeah, and they pull it off by saying, hey, it's a fucking solar eclipse, which means it's important. So,
that's what the circles mean, by the way.
Yeah.
And it's done in, like, the most cornball exposition scene whatsoever, where like before the younger sister was like possessed and was giving like all these cryptic messages, and then the next morning she's like perfectly normal, like yammering about the clips, and she words things in the same hackneyed cryptic messaging when referring to the eclipse, but as like her normal self. And it first time I could give it a pass, like, okay, fine, that works. Yeah. But when it gets to the third time she does it, it's just fucking hysterical.
Yeah, I thought they were pulling a joke at first of, like, a fake out, like, she's saying something that was, like, that the older sister was misinterpreting as what she was saying when she was possessed, you know? But then it wasn't. And so, whatever. So, yeah. The older sister Jan is like, well, I guess fucking blindfold me and do the same thing you did to me, but with as if I was Karen, and then that somehow will fix everything. And they do it, and then they do. So the build-up, to be honest, as this movie went along, I kind of liked it more and more. It kind of felt like in a few ways a giallo film to me without the pretty Italian imagery. So, you know, just like the pacing of like these characters are supposed to be part of the world, and the world is what governs the movie, if that makes sense. But like, it's not.
It's a giallo film that looks like a Hammer horror film, is what you're saying.
Yes, and that doesn't work. It could work if it worked. God, I would love that. But it didn't. And they just kind of do it, and then it happens, and then the only thing that could be considered like a big reveal would be when we don't really see the Watcher, but it's just the eclipse, isn't it? That we just...
Well, now we get into, like, the different endings, alright?
Yes, because this is the only ending that I saw. But I know there's multiple others.
I saw all three. Okay. So, as initially conceived for this film, the original ending involved, like, them all in the chapel, like, doing the ritual, and in comes this giant, like... The twist is that the Watcher in the woods is actually a space alien from another dimension.
Yes, of course.
I like you just took that at face value, like no surprise.
Yeah, of course. That's fine.
Anyway, So space alien comes in, and it's like this big black thing that like has like this like its body looks like a big cloak, and it's got this like ovoid head. Hold on, I'm gonna see if I can find a picture of it and screen share it with you.
Okay, cool.
Here it is. Hold on. Let me just put on screen share. There we go. See what I'm looking at?
Not yet. It's loading.
This one right here. Oh,
interesting.
And admittedly, it looks awkward when it moves. Mm-hmm. You know, a bit
is that fakey. Do you want to click on a few other pictures of it?
Sure. Here's like a more full body shot.
I like that thing.
And then, and so then in the original alternate ending, the alien envelopes Lynn Holly Johnson in its cloak and takes her into the other dimension, which is like this like trippy, like technicolor, multicolor spaceship in like the void of space where Lynn Holly Johnson finds Karen and takes her out of her like suspended animation, and they get transported back to the chapel. Everyone's reunited, happy ending.
Yeah.
Now, the problem was is that this ending required heavy optical effects work in order for this to work. Optical effects work that would not be ready by its planned release date of 1980, which was meant to coincide with the 50th anniversary of Bette Davis's career in film. Why they wanted a release date to coincide with that, I have no fucking idea. But
yeah,
point is that Watcher appears. Point is that this ending was a no-go. So when this film premiered in April 1980 at the Ziegfeld Theater, the ending was changed to cut out the other dimension stuff entirely. So instead, it's just the Watcher and Lynn Holly Johnson transport away, and then like a minute or so later, Lynn Holly Johnson and Karen transport back at the end.
Interesting. Yep.
Right? Great.
Fantastic. And
when they screened this film at the Ziegfeld initially they were going to screen the Ziegfeld and then start to release it nationwide. Audiences who saw it hated the ending. Now the reason why is contested, depending on who you ask. Some people said that it was because the alien itself looked unconvincing and like fake looking, and like too goofy. Like there were reports of test audiences bursting into laughter.
Yeah.
And then others said it was because test audiences were confused by what exactly was going on because that middle section was taken out.
Yeah.
Apparently, an interview with the press regarding the film, when people expressed confusion at the ending, Lynn Holly Johnson started to explain what got cut, you know, like naively.
Yeah.
She was like a 21-year-old girl at the time. And definitely. Supposedly one of the Disney press people actually took the microphone like away from her as she was talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like desperately trying to get her to shut up.
Oh, wow. Poor Lynn Holly Johnson.
But point is that it ended up getting pulled from the Ziegfeld at 10 days. Exhibitors didn't want to touch it. So
yeah.
They end up pulling it for an entire year to like redo the ending, and in its place they re-release Mary Poppins.
Wow.
They apparently go through like the Disney story team goes through like over 100 different, I've heard like in the ballpark of like 131 alternate endings on like how to reshoot this. Now,
that's insane.
Now, John Hugh was not available to reshoot this because he was busy on another project. So instead, to film the final ending was in an uncredited Vincent McEvedy, whom had previously directed like a lot of Disney comedies, like Herbie Goes to Monte Carlo, Herbie Goes Bananas, The Apple Dumpling Gang Rides Again, and probably his greatest achievement, The Million Dollar Duck, one of three films with the honor of being a film Gene Siskel walked out of during his career as a film critic.
Oof.
The other two being Maniac and Black Sheep.
Mm. Interesting.
So then with this new ending, and actually this new ending ties in with the whole plot thread of like the Watcher like possessing Karen to give messages or whatever the hell the little daughter's name is. Not Karen.
I have no idea what the younger sister is called. In my notes, they're just younger and older sister.
Yeah, so the younger sister comes in and it's now fully possessed by the Watcher. And it's like a huge exposition dump explaining what's going on. Mm-hmm. That like when the ritual was occurred, it caused the Watcher to be kept out of its own home dimension and Karen put in its place. Mm. So Karen's been like trapped there in suspended animation in the other dimension for like decades.
Oof.
It's unclear if she was aware of it or not the whole time.
Mm-hmm. If she was aware and alone, or if it was just kind of like a frozen in time kind of thing in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. Like, if it was, like, instantaneous by her perspective.
Yeah, or if she was alone for that length of time and slowly probably going insane.
Yeah. So then the Watcher ends up, like, manifesting itself as, like, a light pillar or something.
Okay.
And fine. Then, like, male love interest has the bright idea to, like, try to break the circle during the ritual because
because he fucking sucks.
Yeah, apparently the film's producers wanted to hit more involvement from him in the climax because they felt it didn't have like a quote-unquote hero.
He was barely a part of the movie. If anyone's the hero, it's Jan. She's the one that's kind of coordinated everything.
Yeah.
She's the closest thing to a protagonist we've got. Who the fuck said that we need to focus on the male love interest more? Fuck you. I mean,
it's 1980 Disney. Of course they focused on that.
I mean, like, if he did anything else in the movie that made him not a dick, maybe I'd root for him, but, like, you know. So, you know. Yeah.
I just don't know. Yeah. So new ending. It ends up getting a wide release. It disappears. And actually, this is the interesting part. There were attempts to make a director's cut of this movie in the early 2000s.
Really?
Yeah.
See, this did gain a cult following.
Yeah. So in the early 2000s, the home video company Anchor Bay had the licensing right for like select catalog Disney titles. Not like any of like the big heavy writers, like B and C grade ones, you know? So one of them that was on their schedule was The Watcher in the Woods. And they were planning to bring John Hugh in and have him like assemble a director's cut and like finish the original ending, like finish the visual effects. Which supposedly Disney kept giving the running around. Oh, those visual effects things don't exist anymore. There's no way to do that. They did, and they could still.
Yeah.
But Supposedly, Michael Eisner was reading an interview in the newspaper where the interviewer praised the head of Anchor Bay for the good work on the DVD box set DVD they did of The Happiest Millionaire, which featured both cuts of the movie, the theatrical and the roadshow cut. Mm-hmm. And at the time, Disney wasn't really like on the ball with the whole DVD game. You know, this is like still in like its early days. And yeah. Michael Eisner, reading this article, got absolutely pissed. Like, who are these Anchor Bay people who have the gall being like, this is like according to one of the guys who was like working on the Blu-ray DVD, who was working on the DVD set at the time. So, you know, take his word for how much whatever you think is worth. But
yeah,
Michael Eisner said, like, who the hell are these guys doing a better job than us? And rather than trying to improve their own DVD game, instead decided to make things harder for Anchor Bay. So there's a lot of infighting between Disney and Anchor Bay. Disney claimed that Anchor Bay did not have the right to do like a director's cut of the movie because of some weird legal mumbo jumbo. They also tried to argue that it didn't have the right to release both cuts of The Happiest Millionaire because the contract called for a release of the movie, not two releases of the movie. Which is weird, but
yeah,
whatever. But eventually, after like a lot of back and forth, eventually Anchor Bay does release Watcher in the Woods on DVD, but rather than a director's cut, they just release the two alternate endings. The original never released one with like the other dimension sequence still unfinished.
Yeah.
And still, for whatever reason, Disney would not let them release the original opening at all because I guess they thought the burning doll was too intense or whatever. Odd. Very odd.
It's very odd. Yeah.
That's pretty much it for Watcher in the Woods. It's just...
There actually I have one more thing to say on it, I think.
Really?
Did you know there was a remake?
Oh, yeah!
So, there was a made-for-television remake in 2017 that didn't really fare much better than the original. It's kind of just got, like, a straight, like, 50 on things, you know? Like, 2 out of 4 stars and all that kind of thing.
Angelica Houston in the Bette Davis role, I believe. Directed by Sabrina the Teenage Witch herself, Melissa Joan Hart.
Yep. And do you want to know my favorite thing about this?
What?
So, the character of John Keller is in this movie, again. He's played by Benedict Taylor, the dude who plays the love interest in the original.
Really?
So he grew up to play the villain, which... probably it feels like a suiting role considering how much of a dick his character was in in the original.
Is the new version more faithful to the book? Because both were produced by Disney-owned companies. This was
Lifetime.
Yeah, which is like 50% owned by Disney.
Yeah,
because Lifetime's owned by A&E Networks, which is like a joint venture between Disney and like Hearst and the Hearst Corporation. Hearst Network.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As far as I can tell, it's just kind of a remake of this movie. I don't know how many. I think there. I don't know what the changes made were. If there were many. So, to be honest, or if they were just like, hey, you know what? Some people liked this movie, and it's got a crowd because of, you know, it's kind of weird little backstory of, you know, changing endings or whatever. So they were like, fuck it, let's make another one. And let me say, Angelica Houston is a great, you can't replace Bette Davis, but like, Angelica Houston's Angelica Houston, you know? And so, her as, that character, good choice, but you know. Yeah. So that's so, really it.
Yeah, this is probably one of our shorter episodes. Might be our shortest. I feel bad. I feel like I wish we had more to say because I feel like we're ripping our audience off.
I don't know. I don't think we are. I think we've said almost all we can in a way, you know?
Yeah, but like, I mean in terms of like length, you know?
We've had short episodes before.
Yeah, but not this short, I don't feel like. I feel like this is less than an hour.
No, I don't think it's good. I don't think it's less than an hour. I think we started around like 8:40 or something like that.
That's right. I thought we started at 9.
Even so, we have like an hour, 12 minutes. We have an hour plus of material. I think one of our shorter episodes was like Max Keeble, and that was like an hour and something.
I think our shortest was the short film showcase one, the Donald Duck Goes to War.
Interesting. But yeah, so I think it's enough as long as it's like an hour. I think that's honestly like a sweet spot, you know? So yeah. That's all I really have in terms of this movie, I think. I wish I liked it better. Again, it has all these elements of things that are clearly present in ways, but don't mix, and some of them are just kind of surface level.
I think this would be my go-to how not to do a horror movie.
Yeah.
Like, hey, you want to learn how to properly give tension, like increase dread in your audience.
Yeah.
Don't do this. And it's all the more hilarious how big of a game Disney talked in their advertisement about how scary this movie was going to be.
Yeah. And it's interesting because apparently, from what I've read, kids were scared of this movie. But like, really? Not much happens that's honestly that scary. Other than I'd say the mirror scene maybe. But other stuff is pretty standard, just like it's pretty bland to look at, to be honest, you know? Because it doesn't go all out in like Hammer film style. And it doesn't go all out in Giallo style either, but it takes kind of like the certain elements from both that don't mix well, in my opinion.
So, do you think talking about this was a better use of our time than watching the vice presidential debates?
Oh, I think so. Yeah. I wish I had lightning powers like the Watcher, so I could just zap. But I don't. I do think, yeah. Yeah.
Is there anything to take away from all this?
Huh?
Is there anything else we can take away from all this?
Is there anything else we can take away from this? Is a great question. I think I'm trying to find a I wish that this would have been a better movie, even if it was solely for Bette Davis. Even if Bette Davis played, and for right now she kind of does, she plays the only like part of this movie that is the least bit interesting. And I think that it's they really needed to just like realize who their icon was for this movie, you know, and that it should have been the mother. And I think it's
Here's the thing. I think the problem with this film is like a split between still Disney holding on to their traditional style and trying to be the new hotness. It creates a compromise that satisfies no one.
Yes.
This formula of Disney trying to be on the cutting edge wouldn't work until they got actual movie executives from outside the system who knew how the modern industry worked and could inject fresh life and like knew who to select. And that would not happen for like another 4 or 5 years. So
I am thankful for Disney's like 80s genre work though.
Even the
ones that didn't work.
I agree. And there's more interesting stuff with their 80s genre stuff to follow.
And that shit wouldn't exist without this. To be completely honest. Because they would have made made the same mistakes on stuff like, say, I don't know, for the example of like sci-fi and stuff like that, if they didn't know what not to do on Black Hole, then they would have fucked up on Tron, you know?
It's true. And so who knows, maybe something wicked this way comes, the other like Disney horror film this era will turn out better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't know, I haven't seen it, but you know, I think it's fun to experiment. I'm glad that they experimented, to be honest. So, yeah.
Yeah.
That's my thoughts on this. I'm glad that they experimented.
It was just a failed experiment.
Yeah, and that's okay. Sometimes you're going to have failed experiments. It's sad that Bette Midler was a part of a failed experiment, though.
Not a Chernobyl, but definitely a chemistry lab explosion.
Yeah. Those are two very... Yeah, this is their failed... This was the chemistry experiment that they got a D minus on at science fair. So that's fine.
All right. So I guess that's it for our show. See you all around, everyone. We'll see you in 2 weeks. From all of us at Lost in the Vault, I'm Dan Agatone.
And I'm the other one.
Signing off.
Next time on Lost in the Vault.
Gracie Mansion. 52 bedrooms. 67 bathrooms. 999 ghosts. And one unsuspecting guest who will come face to face with every one of them. The Haunted Mansion.
Well, you made it this far, so I guess you like our show. Want to support it? Check us out at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Or simply go to our website at anchor.fm/lostinthevault. You can also follow us on Twitter at LostVaultCast and Instagram at LostVaultPodcast. You can also email us at lostinthevaultpodcast@gmail.com or join the official Discord, link in the episode description. And also please remember to rate, review, and share. We really appreciate your feedback. Thanks for listening.